technology policy. He works closely with both Jack Gibbons, the President's science advisor, and the Vice President on a wide range of issues relating to the national information infrastructure, including telecommunications policy, high-performance computing, encryption, and information policy. He's part of the Information Infrastructure Task Force, chaired by Ron Brown, which is responsible for coordinating the administration's NII initiative and is working closely with the Vice President on the administration's new Global Information Infrastructure Initiative to link together national and international networks in a seamless network of networks. He's also co-chair of the Interagency Working Group on Encryption and Telecommunications and is helping to coordinate the administration's efforts to promote environmental technology. He received his Bachelor of Science in Geology from the Caltech in 1981 and a PhD in Geophysics from MIT in 1988. So he's here back home. Nick Mansfield is an information security advisor to shell companies worldwide with specific responsibilities on cryptography matters. He has overseen the development, planning, and implementation of several secure global communications networks in the shell group. He advises on export issues and liaisons with national security authorities. He is currently developing plans for the introduction of the, introduction of the digital signature standard into shell and implementing encryption in shell's email business communications. Nick is really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, on encryption because he's had to deal with it as an advisor in one of the world's largest multinational companies, bringing encryption into, 100 different countries at this point and using it for a variety of things. What I'm going to do is first give a quick summary of some of the observations that I have seen on what's happening with cryptography policy on an international level. And I'd like to start out by just mentioning that, in fact, I believe it is as of yesterday, officially now the OECD has formed a crypto policy group. And this comes under a committee for information, computer, and communications policy. Within that, there's a group of experts on security, privacy, and intellectual property protection. And then under that, there's the group of experts on cryptography policy. They had an initial meeting in December of 95, and that was followed by a business government forum that was sponsored by BIAC, which is the Business Industry Advisory Committee to the OECD, and by the International Chamber of Commerce. At that meeting, representatives from business and governments basically agreed to work together to try to develop encryption guidelines based upon agreed upon principles. And I've summarized there basically the principles: trusted security, voluntary, open, market driven, recognize the national responsibilities, extensible, international, and technically and legally effective. And there was also general support for a trusted third party approach, such as we heard about from George Metakidis earlier. If you haven't seen it, I thought one of the significant things was a statement that was made by the International Business or InfoSec Business Advisory Group, IBAG, that was presented at that Paris meeting. And I've got a copy of that up on my website if you'd like to take a look at it. IBAG represents a lot of the major user groups, really represents the user requirements. And this is just a quick summary of some of the principles that were identified in their statements. Businesses and individuals have the right to protect their information to the level that they desire. Governments have the right to access information. Keys lodged with, I'm sorry, I missed, what was the, is there a typo on this? Keys lodged with trusted parties liable for the loss or damage from compromise or misuse of keys, trusted parties accredited. Keys available to businesses and individuals on proof of ownership of the information. Keys available to governments only under due process of law. Process of obtaining and using keys to be auditable. Governments to establish international agreements that would allow access to keys outside national jurisdiction. Industry to take the lead in developing open, voluntary, consensus international standards. Governments, businesses, and individuals to all work together defining requirements. Standards to allow choices about algorithms, key length, and implementation. And the products conforming to the standards to be generally exportable and not subject to restrictions on import and use. There was also at that meeting a statement that was presented by a quadripartite group consisting of major industry associations throughout the world, representing more than 90% of the information technology industry. Their statement, if you haven't seen it, is also up on my website, and it's basically consistent with the IBAG statement. I said this was going to be fast. The next meeting related to the OECD efforts was a meeting in Canberra in February this year, and this was part of the group on the intellectual property protection and the global information infrastructure. And at that meeting, it was decided to they approved the proposal to establish the group of experts on cryptography policy and to prepare draft guidelines on policy. As I said, that was that proposal was officially accepted by the OECD yesterday, I guess, or very shortly, recently. Some efforts in the trusted third party area, the European Commission had been proposing a 3-year project for establishing a European-wide network of trusted third parties. The UK has been talking about a pilot project using a scheme that was developed by Royal Holloway College. XOpen, which I guess is now called the Open Group, which consists of XOpen and OSF, doing a public key infrastructure and has drafted PKI requirements for global PKI. And these requirements, let's see, I don't have a slide that lists them. A big component of that is data recovery or key escrow that would provide for many of the things that were identified in the IBAG statement. France is also planning to remove their, just as a backup, France has a general licensing requirement for the use of encryption, and they're planning to remove the licensing requirement if keys are escrowed. Okay, some of the hard issues that are being addressed of regulation of trusted third parties, to what extent do they need to be regulated, if at all. Liability, a big concern to users, and I'm sure Nick will touch on the liability issue. Self-escrow, to what extent companies such as Nick's can escrow their own keys. The country where keys are escrowed in exportable products, and international agreements. And there's a lot of discussions going on now related to specific proposals to try to work through those issues. Another big international effort is with the CAPIs, or cryptographic application programming interfaces that basically separate out the crypto from the application level. There can be a number of different levels of interfaces. This just lists a few of them. And again, we heard about the Microsoft CAPI approach earlier. And one of the big issues there is to what extent as was also mentioned, a foreign company, say, could develop cryptography and have it get plugged into the Microsoft interface and be exportable, but in a way that not necessarily the keys would be held in the United States. And so that's the kind of thing that people are working on. Also, the International Cryptography Experiment, which is basically an informal association of people who are interested in trying to work through the issues to develop exportable products that meet all the various requirements. CAPIs are playing a big role in the development of that. Let's see, a recent study that was put out by the Commerce Department and NSA, I didn't have enough time to really review that whole project, so I thought I'd highlight just a couple of things from it that I found were kind of interesting and perhaps surprising. One was that the U.S. market share seemed to be keeping pace with overall demand. General market share of U.S. software, general purpose products, is 75%. There were three exceptions, one Denmark, Switzerland, and the U.K., for general products with encryption capabilities. Visits to 50 computer stores in 7 countries found that all the general purpose software products had with crypto in it came from the United States. They didn't actually find a single product where it didn't. And the general conclusion was that the impact of export controls on general purpose products was negligible. Security-specific products, though, are slightly different. And there you have smaller, more nationalized markets where the U.S. does not dominate. Let's see, a few new developments in exportable cryptography. The Microsoft, also Lotus Notes, recently announced an international version, I like to call it a 6440 encryption scheme. It uses 64-bit keys. 24 of those bits that are used in any particular encryption key are transmitted with the ciphertext encrypted under a key that our government holds, so that we have access to basically 24 of those bits. The other 40 bits have to be obtained by brute force attack. And then finally, Trusted Information Systems has recently announced that they have received approval to export their Gauntlet firewall with using the data encryption standard to provide IP-level security using commercial key escrow system. And this is under the new software key escrow proposal of our government that Mike Nelson will, I'm sure, be talking about. One of the things that they are still trying to deal with is being able to export that product in a way that could accommodate the users of that product in other countries, say being able to have the keys escrowed in those other countries and not in the United States. Okay, and with that, I'm going to turn it over next to Mike.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. Very glad to be back at MIT. It's been 8 years since I finished my PhD here. Not sure I'm glad to be back in these circumstances, but I am glad to be here. I'm one of the two people at the White House who works full-time on information technology issues. Work on everything from telecommunications policy to R&D policy to encryption policy. It's fair to say that privacy and security issues are the hardest issues I work on. Certainly the most challenging, the most vehemently argued, and in some ways the most interesting. I have to say that my MIT education has served me pretty well. My degree is actually in geophysics, which may seem kind of odd since I'm here talking about information technology. But the truth is that having a sense of geologic time is very useful in Washington. When I was here at MIT, I was taught to focus all of my attention on one very small topic so that I, in the end, knew everything there was to know about nothing. In Washington, we have a very different culture. Our goal is to know nothing about everything. I have learned some things in Washington, though, and the first thing I learned about public speaking was that you should always speak clearly and slowly. The second thing I learned is that you should always know if the press is in the room. And the third thing I learned is that you should always avoid speaking to an audience in which 95% of the people vehemently disagree with you. But I'm here anyway. 2 years ago, John Podesta, who at the time was the staff secretary to the president and is one of the leading thinkers on civil liberties in cyberspace, was supposed to speak to this group when you met in Chicago. And at the last minute, as often happens to those of us in the White House, he had to cancel. And a panicked call came to me, and I said, Mike, can you fly to Chicago to go speak to the CPF, the CFP? My response, of course, was, why would I want to do that? So one of my colleagues, David Lytell, got to come instead. I understand the experience was a bit like trying to sell the Edsel. At the time, all that we were offering was the Clipper chip, which is sort of the Edsel of cryptography. Clipper chip was not a success in the marketplace. But actually, it was incredibly successful in another way. And that was that it focused attention on a very important issue, and it got a lot of people, both policymakers and technologists, thinking about this very difficult problem, how to provide effective cryptography without undermining the public safety. And I think we've made a lot of progress since the Clipper chip was first announced. We've made a lot of progress since you met in Chicago. And I think people have taken the Clipper chip as a challenge to provide better policies, better technologies, better options. We haven't found the silver bullet, and I don't think we ever will, but we can find a number of solutions, and we can find ways to meet the needs of more people. And in the last year, I've seen a toning down of the rhetoric as more and more people realize that this is a real problem and that we do have to balance the need for public safety with the balance for good security. I figure that if Clinton gets reelected, we have a chance of solving this problem. I thought what I'd do today is provide an overview of how we see this issue from the White House and talk, and I think what I'll be doing will be my views will be very similar to those of my counterparts in other nations who are all grappling with the same issue. We have the advantage in our country that we've had a very spirited public debate for the last 2 years, and as a result, I think there's been a lot more airing of the different options and a lot more thought onto how we can move forward. So we have a bit of an advantage, but we're all facing, all the nations of the developed world at least, are facing very similar challenges. So let me quickly walk through what we're really up to, and I'll try to do this quickly so that I can move on to questions and answers, because I've heard this speech before, but I haven't heard your questions. First of all, this is, if I can move to the slides, please. I hope this is legible in the back of the room. There's been a lot of misinformation and disinformation about what the administration is trying to accomplish with its cryptography policy. Let me state quite clearly that our goal is to provide users with global encryption solutions that they can trust to protect their privacy and corporate secrets. Two very important words here, global and trust. We need something that will work both in the U.S. and overseas, and we need something that customers can trust. Even if it's a good solution and people don't believe it, they're not going to buy into it. It's not going to be a success in the marketplace. You all know why we need encryption. You can think of lots of different examples of how we can use encryption in applications to protect our private data, protect our corporate secrets. We're clearly going to need good security for telemedicine, electronic commerce, IPR protection. And if these aren't enough examples, you can go read the books by Bill Gates or Nick Negroponte or Don Tapscott or anybody else, we clearly have to have some good solutions here. But there's a catch, and that is that good encryption that you and I can use to protect our privacy can be used by criminals and terrorists to hide their activities. And so the challenge is to find encryption solutions that do not unnecessarily hinder the ability of law enforcement and intelligence agencies to do their job. Very important word here, unnecessarily. We understand that effective, strong encryption is going to make it more difficult for the FBI to do wiretaps. It's going to make it more difficult for our intelligence agencies to collect the data that they need to monitor developments around the world. We understand that. Our goal is to find encryption solutions that don't unnecessarily limit that ability. And that's what we've been pursuing for the last 3 years. The stakes in this are huge. On one side, we have the On one side, we have the commercial sector, which needs to have effective encryption because they are whole new industries that depend upon it. If they have that encryption, they will make billions of dollars, create thousands of new jobs. On the other side, we have the very real possibility that encryption will make it more difficult for us to fight terrorism, nuclear proliferation, chemical, biological weapons proliferation, and drug trafficking, and money laundering, and a whole host of other very unfortunate things. That's the balance we're trying to strike. Billions of dollars, thousands of jobs. We're trying to find a way to generate the billions of dollars of economic growth without losing the thousands of lives. The reason this is so difficult is because so many different players are involved. First and most important are individuals who want effective privacy protection. And we pay a lot of attention to individuals as they vote. Of course, other players include the corporate users, computer hardware and software vendors, government agencies who need effective encryption so that they can provide electronic funds transfer, provide better services to the citizen, law enforcement agencies, and last but not least, the intelligence agencies. Somehow, we have to get all of these people to agree on a common solution that can meet their needs. When we first started to tackle this issue 3 years ago, we set up an interagency working group on encryption and telecommunications, which I've co-chaired for 3 years. That group involves all the key players in the federal government, all of the people who have a stake in this issue. Department of Commerce, DOD, Justice, State, Treasury. At the White House, the National Economic Council, the National Security Council, OMB, and my office are all involved. This has been very effective in that we've got all the issues on the table with all the key players around the table. And in that sense, we're a year or two or three ahead of other countries where they're just beginning to work the process. I think you're all familiar with the fundamentals of U.S. encryption policy. First off, we have no controls on the domestic use or import of encryption products. Second, we have not proposed any changes in the very strong protections to your privacy. The wiretap statutes, the laws on search and seizure, none of those are changing. For several years, we've allowed the export of mass market software with key lengths of up to 40 bits. It's very easy to get a license to do that. And last, we are working with industry to explore ways that they will be able to export other types of encryption, stronger forms of encryption, for particular algorithms and particular end users. Last year, we provided about over 2,000 export licenses for companies that wanted to export products that were stronger than 40-bit. So there's a lot of American companies making a lot of money exporting products that are stronger than 40-bit. This is a short history of U.S. encryption policy. Back before 1983, it was almost impossible to export anything. In 83, the Commerce Department began issuing licenses for a wide range of cryptography products used for authentication and other purposes, but not for confidentiality. In 1992, the Bush administration negotiated with industry and decided to allow the export of 40-bit encryption software. We heard from industry that that wasn't enough, and so we went forward looking for other ways to solve the problem. And that's in 1983 was when we announced that we would make the Clipper chip a standard for government use and encourage others to use it. In 94, we finalized that standard, and we heard again from industry that this wasn't enough. In particular, they didn't want a hardware they wanted not only a hardware solution, they wanted software solutions, and they wanted to develop them themselves. And so in August of last year, we announced an initiative to allow the export of very strong crypto, provided it had a key escrow feature. I think most of you are very, very, very familiar with how key escrow works. Some of you have probably even designed systems to make it work. But the idea is that within any packet of data encrypted with a key escrow system, there will be data, encrypted data, that will enable law enforcement agencies to determine what product did the encryption so that they can then go and get a warrant for recovery of the key for that particular product, that particular unit, and then they can use that key to decrypt the communications. The idea here is to ensure that the user has very strong encryption, that no unauthorized person can break, while at the same time enabling law enforcement to do its job, to do a wiretap or to do a search and seizure and read the data. As I mentioned, we announced that we were going to promote key escrow encryption software and allow its export back in August of last year. In September, we held a public meeting to discuss the criteria that products would have to meet in order to be easily exported. And at that meeting, there was a lot of discussion about how the keys would be held, how they would be accessed, and so we went forward and developed key escrow agent criteria in addition to revising the export criteria. We had hoped by now to have a final version of both the export criteria and the escrow agent criteria, but we've had a lot of feedback from industry, a lot of discussion, a lot of negotiation, and so we're still doing some work on the final criteria. However, we have already allowed the export of some key escrow products which meet the draft criteria. And Dorothy mentioned one product, the Trusted Information Systems Gauntlet Firewall, but there are other products that will be exportable with very strong crypto with a key escrow feature. The Clipper chip showed that you could actually build a system that would work. It didn't show that you could build one that would sell. Other companies are doing that. And Bankers Trust, Trusted Information Systems, Hewlett-Packard, there are a number of proposals from academia on how you could do key escrow. And we are avidly looking for other approaches that would provide the strong encryption that users want while providing the law enforcement access that we need to defend the public safety. What's really been going on here is something I'd like to illustrate with a couple of graphs. Being a scientist, I like to graph everything. This is the debate we've been having for the last 15, 20 years. We've been having a one-dimensional debate. We've been going back and forth along this line, arguing about what the right bit length is. And law enforcement will tell you 40-bit is too much, and all of you in the audience will say 56 is too little. So there's been this debate back and forth, and no resolution, no progress, a lot of frustration. So what we really need to do is find another dimension to argue in. And that's what we've done, is we've now added this other dimension, which is ease of access to the key. You can still develop systems down here which don't have keys, or at least won't be keys that won't be accessible. On the other hand, we can build escrowed systems that will allow access to the key. And so the question now is, how can we find solutions somewhere in this space that will meet everyone's needs? The problem, of course, is that different groups tell us that there are parts of this graph that are off limits. Let's see, I thought I had a pin here. Right? So if you talk to law enforcement, they'll tell you that everything over there is off limits. This is a bit like a linear programming problem. So they'll tell you everything off there is off limits. Users will tell you all that is off limits. National security will tell you all that's off limits. My hope is that there's a finite space left when we're done here. The manufacturers will tell you all that's off limits. My hope is that we do have the space in here that we can find solutions. So the challenge for us is to make that space, solution space, bigger, to look for other approaches, new ways to do this, in the hope that we can find some solution that fits in the mix. Now that I've permanently marked the screen. This is a tough issue, and I'm here to listen to your ideas on how to do this, because we need some more ideas. It's easy to see why this is so tough, though, and it touches on all these hot-button issues. Privacy, wiretapping, touches on intelligence gathering, which is a very difficult issue to discuss publicly. When you start talking about international systems and U.S. crypto being used in other countries and vice versa, you touch on national sovereignty issues, whether nations will actually be able to fight crime within their borders. There's the general problem of fear of technology. And there are lots of trade and competitiveness issues. A lot of countries overseas are very worried that the key escrow approaches we're promoting are actually just designed to help U.S. companies dominate the world market. So it does involve a real maelstrom of issues. Luckily, abortion and race are not on the list. But it's about as hard as it gets. Most of the issues I work on are a lot of fun. I mean, I get to write memos to the vice president that say things like, option A, do this, you will generate 5 million new jobs, you will make government twice as efficient, and you will dramatically improve our education system. Option B, you will do all of that and cure cancer too. On this issue, it's more like option A, you will be accused of invading the privacy of every American. Option B, you'll be accused of coddling terrorists and child pornographers. Option C, you will get both. And so far, that's what we've accomplished. Let me give you my list of hard issues that I'd like some help on as we move forward. I haven't talked much about the international aspects of this because I think it's important that we explain what the U.S. is trying to do and as an example of what nations around the world are trying to do. But you can see that there are international aspects of this, and we have to find global solutions. If we have key escrow solutions, we have to find ways that they can work in all countries, meet the needs of all the countries that want to use it. But I have a list of just questions to throw out to the audience. First question I'd like an answer to is this. Back the adoption of cryptography today. In the U.S., people can use whatever they want. And yet, probably 2-3% of all computers have some kind of effective crypto on them? I think that's, we need to think about that and wonder how we can promote the use of effective encryption. The second question is with key escrow is how do we determine who gets access to the keys, and what procedures will be in place to ensure that those keys are not abused. Another very important question for me is how do we build a key escrow system here in the U.S. which will be acceptable to other countries. Here we are trying to adopt and promote a key escrow system which only the U.S. law enforcement can read. What's the French law enforcement ministry going to think of that? Or the Singapore government? Or the Nigerian government? This leads to another very important question: how are law enforcement agencies going to cooperate? If German technology, even key escrow technology, starts being used by terrorists in the U.S., there has to be some way that the law enforcement agencies can work together. Another very important question is how do we validate that products work? It's a very real problem today. People don't know if the crypto they're buying does what it says it does. Crypto is a bit like antibiotics. You can't judge the stuff just by looking at the pills. And even if after you use it, you don't know that it actually works. So there needs to be some way to help customers understand or evaluate their products. We have some very interesting trade and competitiveness issues here. If countries are saying that people within their country can only use certain products, certain crypto products, that's a trade barrier. How do we deal with that? Another very important question is the standards process. What role does ISO or ITU play in promoting the development of some global standards for encryption? Another very serious problem is the fact that we have different privacy laws in different countries, and so it's hard to see how we can move to a global system. And an even more interesting issue is liability. If we do build key escrow systems, there's a question of what is the liability for the key escrow holders. There's also a liability question if a company uses crypto without key escrow, and then it turns out someone goes in and decrypts some of their fundamental, their most important files. Are they liable because they weren't using key escrow and they don't have a way into those files anymore, that they've lost this important data? And another last issue, which is a very complex issue, is how do you build the infrastructure that would be needed to do key escrow and to do all the other things we need to do in cyberspace, like digital signatures, digital time stamping? How do we attach an identity to a person in cyberspace? Today, if someone gets my password or can log in as me, they become me. How do we avoid that problem? So lots of issues out there. At this point, I see four different possible paths. One of them is the scenario I call crypto chaos, sort of what we have today. Lots of different, you don't like what we have today, as I recall. The point is that we have lots of varying rules and regulations in different countries. We have a number of different technologies, some good, some bad. We have no hope of a global standard. Second possible solution is what I call key escrow world, where you do see the adoption of key escrow solutions. You see de facto standards developing from the major companies, major players. That's actually the best for industry and best for users, and that they can actually use these systems across borders. The third would be sort of a combination of the first two. You get some key escrow solutions, but we still don't have any standardization. We still have a big mess, no compatibility, major problems. And the fourth is the one you'd like, which is no controls on anything. And I have to say, you're not going to see that. Not in this country and not in other countries. So we've got to find some way through this. And I do think we're experimenting. We are finding some new approaches. The Lotus approach that Dorothy mentioned is one. But To close, I'd like to just offer you a challenge. And I would ask you to pretend that you are me. You don't have to wear a suit. The point is, your assignment is to find a solution that you can propose to your bosses that will provide effective encryption and will either make everybody happy or make everybody equally unhappy, which is usually the best we can do. And you have constraints, as in this linear programming problem, on what solutions will work. The first constraint is that if strong encryption is widely available overseas, it will undermine national security, and lots of people will die. I know you don't believe that, but that's a given. Number two, if US companies can't market encryption that customers can trust, they will lose market share and sales. The third constraint is that if strong encryption is widespread, we'll see an increase in crime and terrorism here in the US, and we'll have to deal with that. The fourth constraint is that without effective encryption, US companies and individuals will continue to be vulnerable to espionage, computer crime, and loss of privacy. The fifth constraint is that if we allow strong encryption to spread overseas, it will undermine our allies' efforts to fight terrorism and undermine our effort to work with them to stop nuclear proliferation and other threats. The next constraint is that we, the US government, need this stuff. We've got lots of applications we'd like to use it for, from tax filing to welfare payments, you name it. Another problem is that no one knows if the crypto they're buying is really any good. And any solution that we endorse is immediately suspect. Which leads to the last and most difficult constraint, which is that nobody trusts anyone. And that's one of the reasons this has been so difficult. But given those nine constraints, I challenge you to find a solution that works. It's not an easy problem. But there is a bottom line, and that is that we think it would be very irresponsible not to seek encryption solutions that provide the protection of strong encryption without undermining law enforcement and national security. Look forward to your questions.
In the interest of time, we'll have Nick speak next, and then we'll have a discussion period when he finishes.
Thank you, Dorothy, for inviting me to come and speak here. May I just say to start with that from my perspective, the one who actually has to meet the road with the rubber, and that I can actually solve all my immediate problems. The difficulty is that it is at high cost and by and large uses proprietary solutions. So let us have no misunderstandings that we can't solve the problems within companies. We can, but at those two constraints. Allow me also to say that the reason that I'm very pleased to take up this offer is that we are interested in international standards for all the reasons that Mike Nelson's just given. I, in fact, took part in the OECD-ICC meeting in Paris, and a colleague of mine is the chairman of IBAG, the InfoSec Business Advisory Group to the European Commission, and we are interested in open, voluntary, consensus, international standards. Standards are no good if they are national. We do see all the linkages, and I hope by the end of my presentation that you'll get some feel for the sort of issues that I have to deal with, and that the way we go about it today, and perhaps in what we do today, there are some lessons for the future. Can we switch, please? the purpose of this slide, of all the pictures really, is just to sort of walk around and give you a flavor for the sort of things that we're talking about. First of all, Shell Group of Companies is not one company. It is a group of companies of over 250 plus companies, some of which are wholly owned by Shell, some of which are partnerships, enterprise partnerships. In some cases, enterprise partnerships with companies you might think of as our competitors, like Exxon. In other cases, the partnerships are with actually local governments, where, for example, Mike mentioned Nigeria, then the company in Nigeria is 70% owned by the Nigerian government and 30% owned by Shell and operated by Shell. In other places, we are the operator. We don't own the company, but we operate it. And that, of course, brings into it other issues. But walking around this little diagram, if we start at the top left, you see an oil rig. I'm concerned with health and safety. One of the lessons of the Piper Alpha incident in the North Sea was that IT on oil rigs had to be subject to the same safety considerations as anything else. And for those of you who want to know a number, that means an incident once in every 100 years. Now, if you want to provide things like remote software maintenance from a vendor company, that very attractive, I will say, from a cost point of view, you have to be able to give the reassurance that you're meeting those safety standards. The next little picture on the go round is an oil tanker. Many of you may not realize that when an oil tanker leaves the Far East, the ship, the crew, and the cargo are all separate items, and each is bought and sold on the journey, perhaps several times. So the ownership of the ship, the cargo, the crew may be completely different at the point of destination than it was at the point of departure. This poses some interesting problems if you're going to use proprietary solutions as we are at present. But the next picture you'll see is could either be a refinery or a chemical works. In the globalization of our business, we are seeking to optimize our processes. Now, in the old days, we had this just in time. Nowadays, what we would really like to do is to vary the output of our chemical factory or our oil refinery based upon the spot market price to optimize the profits. This, of course, means that you need to have your experts concentrated and working remotely. Now, the prospect of having insecure communications to a refinery where you're controlling it from many, perhaps, continents away is frightening. Certainly, if you go to Rotterdam and you look at the largest refinery in the world, you will note that there are houses within 500 meters of the main catalytic converters. And certainly, for the people living in those houses, they would like some assurance that they are living in a safe place. Lastly, we look at the petrol station, something you're probably more familiar with. The petrol stations are a little bit like McDonald's. They're franchises. In many cases, again, the ownership is changing. It's complex relationships between the supplier and the seller. Not all petrol stations are wholly owned by the brand you see on the outside. This diagram really, although it's a picture of the Shell diagrams, the important thing is the line, and I will put my pen on the line. Above the line, we're concerned with the shareholder. And the shareholder invests about $70 billion in our business. And he likes to know that he's going to get a return on his investment. He also likes to know that we run the companies properly below the line. And if you look at the below the line, and you look at the box here, then you'll see that over 100 countries, lots of different relationships, but somehow we have to be accountable to the shareholders. And that accountability is extremely important. Why do we need confidentiality? Well, you might say that list of four is a pretty standard list. Well, perhaps if I can put some bones on that list of four. I can only say that I agree. We have plenty of evidence that since the end of the Cold War that we are now into an era of economic competitiveness. And if you are in a primary industry as we are, it comes as no surprise that we become a target for national surveillance. But what I find interesting is that at every gathering I hear government people saying that how terrible it is for foreigners spying on their industry. Well, if you go around enough countries, you'll realize that everybody is spying on everybody else. So just as I consider countries outside the US who might be spying on me, I also have to take consideration that the American National Security Agency, with legitimate interests of national, US national interests, is also going to spy on us. So this should not be any great surprise, and neither am I affronted or even upset by it. It's just part of the life in the global village. Information broking. This is a slightly more serious one as far as we're concerned on a day-to-day. And as I said earlier, some of our partners are perhaps our competitors. And this particular slide was actually put together by our security colleagues in Exxon. They were trying to unravel information broking and contract fixing. And this is the diagram they came up with. The important point about this diagram is not the detail, but the complexity. We are dealing with very, very sophisticated professional information broking attempts. We've now reached the point where the major oil producers are getting together and putting together a task force to try and monitor it, to share information. We don't mind competing, but we'd like outside influences kept to a minimum. This is a wonderful catch-all. Nobody tells me what measures I've got to take to protect private information. And this is one of the most difficult things today. At the moment, we have many data protection laws, but nobody tells me how much protection. If I log on in the morning in The Hague, where I'm based, I access immediately servers in London, The Hague, perhaps Spain or perhaps Germany. I have no idea whether or not I am breaking or meeting data protection acts as I access data across those seamless boundaries. All I know is that as a security advisor, I give my best advice, which is usually the highest watermark and the most expensive and the least well received. Let us look at the new business environment. I said we're globalized. If I said there are approximately 80,000 users who wear shell badges in our directory, and if you count our enterprise partners, perhaps over 500,000 users, exchanging email globally, seamlessly, every day, I would probably be underestimating it. We are one of the largest email businesses in the world, and it's in our own right. And that's just what you would call internal traffic. This business environment is getting more and more complex. Not only is it getting more and more complex, but it's getting more and more dynamic. Relationships are changing daily. It is sometimes difficult to know whether the directory is out of date by a day or a week or a month. The only thing I can say is it's always out of date. Changing networks. Well, we started off with a nice machine-style organization in the 80s. Everything was nicely ordered. As I put in my handout, we could dictate security policy quite simply because we could lay it down and distribute it. And there was a nice ring fence around anything we did. As we move into the 90s, we become more and more connected. We used to have places where there were two plugs on the wall. One plug took you to the shell LAN. And that meant you were in the shell world. and the other plug was everybody else. Nowadays, people walk into the office and they just plug into whichever one is empty, because quite frankly, it makes no difference. As we go forward into the next century, we are looking at mobility. We already have road warriors. We already have people traveling in cars, with notebook PCs, with mobile telephones, remote accessing data across countries, across boundaries, and dealing with large sums of money. It is changing, and it is changing very, very quickly. I am aghast when I hear people from the EC saying that if I'm lucky, I'll get some guidance in 1998, which may mean, of course, that I'll get something out of a European community in about the year 2000, 2001. I have to solve these problems today. I cannot wait another 5 or 6 years. I put this slide up to give you a little taste. You can't see very clearly, but I'm the guy waving the flag. I could write a book from here to the back of this room documenting all the different cryptography controls and regulations and rules that I've come across and have to conform to. We have put crypto for legitimate purposes in over 100 countries. And I can tell you that meeting all the regulations of export, import, usage, approval, equipment approval, electrical approval, and all the other little barriers that countries dream up is a nightmare. And I, for one, would like to see some international standards, if only to reduce the complexity of the problem. Believe it or not, the systems don't even match each other. So, for example, the US will ask for an import and usage statement from the country of destination, and yet the import country doesn't have a mechanism to produce one. So you're then stuck with being unable to fulfill the requirement because the other partner in the equation doesn't recognize what the first partner is demanding. This sort of situation is typical and certainly not getting easier. I would say quite the opposite. Far from getting simpler, the more and more countries that had no regulations are waking up to the fact that they need to have regulations, or rather they feel they need to have regulations. And certainly the more you fuel your debate in your country, the more they're encouraged to believe that they should do something in their own. I say it for a different reason. And when I finish, you may not clap. But firstly, I cannot give an assurance to my shareholders and my business of the security of something that I know nothing about. So quite simply, from a liability point of view, I cannot give a liability statement or a risk assessment if I don't know what's in the box. Secondly, my operating companies won't use something which is a black box. They will turn around to me and they will say, how do I know it's secure? And if I say, trust me, they'll say, why? Perhaps I should sort of answer one of Mike Nelson's questions, which is, the challenge is to find a solution, not that we trust someone, but to accept that we all have to have a degree of mistrust. That degree may be higher in some places than others, but nevertheless, there is a degree of mistrust that should be recognized. But also, I would say on the other side, is that we have to control our business. I said right at the beginning, I have a shareholder interest to look after. And therefore, we will escrow our keys, not because we're invading the privacy of our operating companies, but simply because we would not be responsible if we didn't. Can you imagine going to a shareholders meeting after you had a Barings Bank type affair when one of your employees has embezzled a lot of money and being able to say, I'm sorry, we had no way of knowing what was going on because we have no access to his records. I think very quickly we would lose business confidence. And may I say, without our shareholder money, we don't have a business. Where do I think we're going? Well, we're going towards information wars. Just to give you a little snippet, our manufacturing area recently put all its manufacturing reference manuals onto an online server so that all the engineers could have wonderful access to it. It realized, just as it had finished the job from a technical standpoint, that it had just put all the intellectual property of our manufacturing capability and made it available, freely available, just about everybody. And then I will say to you that we had a recent contract with a Middle Eastern country to build a gas plant, and part of that contract had a substantial amount of money for the transfer of knowledge. Now, there's very little point in making a contract for the transfer of knowledge if you're then going to make it freely available through a server. So, and this touches upon the intellectual property. But certainly information wars is something that we feel is definitely coming down the road, because at the end of the day, the only thing that we have in terms of competitiveness is our knowledge and our ability to apply resources with that knowledge. Since the previous speaker sort of gave his party political plug, perhaps I should give mine. I am a member of the Open Group Security Business Requirements group, and underneath that you have the ex-Open and the OSF technicians. At the moment there's a total disconnect between the technical fraternity, the vendors, and the high-level policymakers. It's no point in having policy if the technical infrastructure won't support it, and there's no point in building technical infrastructure if it doesn't conform to a policy. And I, as a member of business, sit in the middle saying, please, can you both get your act together? One of the things I think is key to that is the concept of some form of cryptographic passport. Now, in the technical fraternity, most people will say that an X509 version 3 certificate is something which everybody could use as a unit of cryptographic currency. It may sound like a technical matter, and it may sound like a small matter. But if you're in an organization like mine, and you're looking to move and integrate directories, knowing where to go and knowing how to do it becomes very, very important, especially when you consider the cost. And to know that we were going towards some common cryptographic passport, whatever it might contain, and that can be debated elsewhere, at least those of us who have to make decisions which are expensive and long-term can make them with some confidence that, okay, the detail might not be right, but at least we've got some basic framework to work to. And that's really my hobby horse. Because at the moment, this disconnect means that without a basic standard, you will not see anything that the policymakers say come to reality, and companies like mine will continue to develop and deploy proprietary solutions which are expensive, hard to maintain, and do very little to promote global business. Thank you.
So we'll open it up for discussion now, and you can direct questions to either Mike or Nick.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, John.
No. I'm not John. This is Eric.
Oh, it's Eric.
At least Don Hopkins isn't here today. Mike, is the administration in favor of outlawing non-escrowed cryptography in the United States or not?
No.
No? You're not. Now, it would appear to me that from all the policy things you put up there that you would be in favor of this. So was there some part of the presentation I missed?
I didn't talk about the Bill of Rights. But we do think that's important in cyberspace or anywhere else.
But While I'm gratified to hear you say that, it doesn't seem to be consistent with what you said earlier.
It's perfectly consistent with what we're saying. Our main concern is that we need to control the spread of strong crypto overseas, because without the information we have today, we are handicapped. We'd be shooting our ears off, as one of my friends at a certain agency says, if we were to allow the spread of very strong encryption overseas. The fact is if we hadn't had the capabilities we have today, in the last 10 years you would have seen major wars, you would have seen American airliners shot out of the sky, you would have seen a lot more incidents like the Oklahoma City bombing, or the World Trade Center bombing. That's the facts. It's a very serious matter, and we're trying to find a way to preserve our ability to collect information and intelligence overseas and provide you with the solutions you need.
A question for Mr. Nelson. Every proposal that the government has made in this area has had one common denominator, an assurance that our privacy will be protected in a key escrow world by application to the court for permission to get escrow key. In the 25-year experience under the Wiretap Act, which is the closest available analogy, the court's own statistics show that out of the roughly 1,000 or so applications made to TAP, roughly one a year is denied and all the others are granted. Those statistics are now obsolete. Two were denied in 1988 by any state or federal court, and since then, zero have been denied by any state or federal court for an original wiretap application. Now, this is even a rubber stamp runs out of ink now and then. How can you assure us that our privacy will be protected by application to the judicial branch when they seem to be rubber stamping all your wiretap applications?
I guess I'm missing something. The fact that those are approved means that the proper evidence was provided, proper justification for the wiretap was presented to the judge. I'm missing something here. If a company goes and has a product that gets approved a million times by some standard-setting body, does that mean the standard-setting body is defective? It means the company is doing what it's supposed to do. The fact is that this approach to key escrow is very similar to the wiretap approach. All the same safeguards would be in place for that we have for wiretaps. And the fact is you're not seeing the abuses of wiretaps that we saw 20 years ago. The things the Church Commission exposed, the abuses under J. Edgar Hoover. And it's because we have very strong laws here to protect privacy, and they are effectively applied.
So all the wiretap applications are perfect, and therefore they're all granted. Is that your response?
You can look at them. They meet the requirements. They provide the proof necessary. It's worth noting that we don't do a lot of wiretaps. I mean, it is a tool that we don't use very often in this country because it's sort of the last. It's what you use when you don't have enough evidence otherwise. It's what you use when it's worth the cost and expense to do it.
Let me just add to that, and then I'd like to go on to the next person. But somebody in the FBI once described it to me as 15 chefs in the kitchen. The process that they have to go through to actually even before they can even take their application to the judge. And these things get rejected within the law enforcement agencies now before they even make it to the court for the judge to sign off. But you don't see those statistics. But I'd like to take the next question.
A question for Mike Nelson. I was pleased to hear about the 2,000 export licenses for crypto greater than 40 bits. Were any of those for triple DES?
Not for confidentiality applications.
And what was the largest key length that was?
Some of them are proprietary algorithms, and I really don't know what the key length is, but they're very various different implementations, and you can go to the State Department and they can talk to you about the different strengths that were exported, but there is very strong crypto being exported now for specific applications for specific countries.
Thank you.
Mike, I had an observation. You said in your statement that
people want crypto and the government needs access, and I think this is backwards. I believe the people have a need for cryptography and the government wants access, and this is an important distinction. I think they need both, and I think the American people need for its government to have access if we're going to have the public safety we enjoy. I like your T-shirt, by the way.
You mentioned the Oklahoma City bombing case, where a bunch of people who were presumably previously unknown built a bomb, drove it up, and destroyed a building and killed 150 people. How would having access to their encrypted communications have made any difference if you didn't expect them to do this? There are a lot of people. Are you going to go on fishing expeditions to find people who might be discussing building bombs or blowing up buildings? I don't see that you would catch any more people because these people were not suspected in the first place until after the fact.
There are actually two lessons from the Oklahoma City bombing case. And that first one is that small terrorist cells can do a lot of things and get away with it. But my example was not that having access to encrypted communications might have stopped that case. My example is that if you have terrorist cells that are able to operate effectively across international borders without detection, you're going to see a lot more of those kinds of cases. The other thing that's interesting is that those guys were able to do some amazing damage, but they weren't very bright. The guy got picked up speeding out of Oklahoma City at 85 miles an hour without a license plate. It's not a good way to escape detection. And so when I hear people tell me, well, these guys are going to get the crypto anyway, I have to wonder. This guy's going to buy what's available in Egghead software. And that's why we're trying to make sure that those products are ones that we're trying to encourage the development of key escrow products that will be available widely. But the fact is people are going to do things. We're still going to have terrorists. We're still going to have child pornography. We're still going to have a lot of crime. The question is, what can we do to give law enforcement the tools to reduce that threat? And I think this is the proposal we put on the table is a way to do that.
If I could follow up?
Actually, I think I'd like to move on. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Perrin, Industry Canada. I'm a vice chair of the Privacy Security Experts Group that Dorothy mentioned that's been set up under the OECD. I'd like to make three points. My compliments to an excellent presentation of how difficult this process is going to be on all three sides. It's going to be difficult. For Michael Nelson, there's one stakeholder that I think slips between two chairs here, and that is small and medium business. I realize some of their needs are similar to individuals, but they're quite different from corporations, and I wonder how we can involve them more in the process that is going on to try and arrive at solutions. Number two, and I guess that relates to that, education. Clipper, above all else, was the most innovative educational tool in this area I've ever seen. Thanks to Clipper, hundreds of thousands of people know what cryptography, or at least have a notion of cryptography now that have never heard of it, so thank you for that. But I think the job isn't done yet, and I wonder how we get the message out, particularly to the stakeholders like small business who unfortunately aren't even aware that they need to encrypt their data on a global network. And they're important because they're some of the hope for the real promise of the GIS. And then number three is human rights. And I don't want to devolve off into a long discussion of privacy rights here, but one of the concerns about us hatching this set of guidelines at the OECD, whatever your level of cynicism, at least the countries at the OECD are basically democracies. We are trying for the middle path here, and there are checks and balances of varying degrees of efficacy in these democracies to ensure that we do hit the middle path. This is not necessarily the case in the rest of the world. I'm not suggesting for a minute that this is a topic you'd like to throw on the floor of the United Nations. That would certainly slow it down. But whatever solutions we reach must be exportable to third world countries. Without harping on it, we don't need to discuss in this crowd the fact that any public key system with escrow is a powerful enabling tool for surveillance, And I wonder how we can, when the rubber hits the road, as you put it, how we can figure out solutions that will be robust enough to stand in third world countries.
I think I'm going to let you. I think Nick actually probably can answer the first two questions better than I can. So. And he hasn't had any questions yet.
No. I actually have an interest in small, medium-sized enterprises, principally because that is the subject that the European Commission has been, if you like, bombarding the corporate security people like myself and saying, well, okay, large corporations can sort yourselves out. What about the small and medium-sized enterprises? If I might offer a sort of top and bottom of the model, the bottom of the model is PGP, where you can create your own key, and if the person receiving that key believes it's you, then fine. So that's the bottom of the model. So in the middle, we have the small and medium-sized enterprises, and what is tending to happen at the moment is, particularly for things like digital signatures, then the large corporations are by and large picking up the tab. In other words, if an enterprise partner of mine is a small enterprise, when I say a small enterprise, in our case, it might easily be a brokerage or a merchant bank. Then they come to us and we have to provide it. And that is not a satisfactory solution. And that is why in the European Commission, the Trusted Third Party initiative was started, because it was recognized that was probably the only thing you could put into place. A small and medium-sized enterprise cannot afford to do what large corporations can do, and may I suggest that the PGP trust model is wholly inadequate. So if you accept that, then certainly in Europe, the trust of third party is the route we're going. And as Mike has said earlier, there is little happening at the moment over in Europe that is not being shared over here. And there is certainly no divergence of views. Not that I've heard of, anyway.
If I can just pick up on the education question. I certainly agree we've only gone so far on this issue. The worst thing about Clipper Chip is that it has actually convinced millions of people that all you've got to do to ensure information security is to provide good crypto. As I see it, that's about 10% of the problem. Crypto can protect your data, but that's not very helpful if somebody can break in your system and delete all your data or corrupt every other bit. And there's a lot of problems out there that need more attention in the security area. And unfortunately, I think we're probably going to see some very dramatic incidents where systems are compromised and lives are lost or billions of dollars are stolen. And that probably will wake up a few people. But there's a lot more education that does need to be done, not only on encryption, but also on the bigger, broader questions of information security. I worry a lot about your third question, too, about human rights. How can we ensure that the systems we're promoting will be acceptable and usable in third world countries where there isn't protections for human rights? How can we build a key escrow system where the keys will be only released when there is reason for an investigation, not when some authoritarian government wants to monitor its law-abiding citizens? And we have to work that. We have to find that solution. I think in the end, if we find an attractive, marketable solution, one that does meet the needs of civilized countries, it will spread very quickly, and it can very well become a tool for dissidents and for people in third world countries and authoritarian countries where good crypto can provide the protection they need to spread information and receive information and get their story out to the world. But we need some work on that, and I don't think some of the organizations that deal with these issues, human rights issues, haven't been working hard enough on these issues. I hope they get more involved in the future.
Hi, my name is Robert Hedinga. I think you guys are missing the point here. The point is that the horse is out of the barn. You can no more stop cryptography than you can stop flight. More to the point, you can't stop the kind of cryptography that has already been sort of turned loose on the net. It's going to become much more important to have strong cryptography for things like digital commerce. I mean, wait until people start issuing digital securities on the net, anonymous digital securities, anonymous bearer bonds, if you will, and the world's going to get turned upside down. Finally, I'd take issue to the whole vertical axis of the pseudo chart you put up. And specifically, you're using numerical data on the horizontal axis, and you're using qualitative data on the vertical axis. And if I remember right, Dr. Tufte, called that a profit chart, which is entirely appropriate given the circumstances. Thank you.
I'm glad you raised the question of whether the horse is out of the barn. The fact is that DES has been publicly available for over 15 years. Anybody with a computer could take it, program it, put it on their system. And yet DES is not in every computer, it's not in every software package, it's not universally available. And the fact is that U.S. software companies come into my office on at least a weekly basis to complain about the fact that our export controls are having the effect they were intended to have. They are slowing the spread of crypto to places we don't want it to go. So you can't have it both ways. Okay. The other point is that the fact is that most of the crypto that's out there is not very good. Even if it says it's triple DES, it's got problems. Netscape developed 128-bit encryption for its browser. Their chief scientist is one of the best cryptographers in the world, and yet it wasn't implemented quite right. And so here's one of the best companies in the world making mistakes. We have some of the best cryptographers in the world. We can find those mistakes. The fact is, until people have systems they can trust, you're not going to see widespread use of encryption. You're not going to see it in every computer. You're not going to see people like Nick Mansfield buying systems and putting it on every computer until they know that there's something that actually works. We think that if we move forward, find a solution that actually works, one that governments and big companies can test and endorse, that we can move the market in that direction. Until then, we're going to have crypto chaos. And that actually works pretty well for the intelligence agencies. All these people using all these products, most of which are defective. That was the most important result of the study that Dorothy mentioned from the Bureau of Export Administration, Department of Commerce. You should read that study. If you could, you should read the classified study. Because it makes very clear that most of the crypto out in the world, in the marketplace today, overseas, has flaws. So the horse is out of the barn, but most of the horses are lame.
Hi. I'm Alan Davidson from CDT. I had a quick question for Mike Nelson. A couple weeks ago, two new bills were introduced in Congress by a broad group of both Republicans and Democrats. Major provision of these bills says that we're going to raise export controls so that if something's available at Egghead Software or it's widely out there on the net, we ought to be able to export it. Could you tell us what the administration's position is on that, on those bills?
I suspect we'll be testifying on that and providing detailed comments on the bill. We, of course, do think that export controls are a very important tool for controlling encryption overseas, and we would oppose those provisions. We do think the Leahy bill is a very helpful bill, though, in that it does focus attention on this issue. There are some provisions in there that would help build a legal framework for key escrow encryption, to criminalize unauthorized release of keys. There are a number of helpful things in that bill, and we are working with Senator Leahy and his staff. I just met with Beryl Howe yesterday, and I think we can make some progress on it. But the most troubling piece is the part that would essentially decontrol strong crypto, and that we don't think that's the answer.
Hi. We've recently had some interesting stories, true stories, we believe, come over a mailing list I'm on, describing how PGP helped the resistance, sort of, in Romania, how it protected people who would otherwise have suffered greatly. And so while I'm sitting at the back with everybody else, but listening to you talking about how you want to keep terrorists from having strong encryption and so on, I have to ask, where does the line between terrorists and freedom fighter come for the American government? And how does your list of friendly governments who we trust, they're nice people, they're like us, interact with the relationship of the man to your right, who works for a company which works in several countries which perhaps the American government doesn't consider so friendly, and through no fault of his own also has to provide security there? How do those two, the interaction of your international community of democratic or fun-loving nations and your and international corporations who, for business reasons, possibly don't follow those nice people lists?
I got that story about the Romanian dissidents as well, and because I've got a lot of people out there who send me a lot of mail on this issue, as you can imagine. That's not an invitation for more, by the way. I actually read that story in a somewhat different way. I asked myself, is there anything in this story that would be different if they were using a key escrow encryption product where the keys were escrowed in the U.S.? And the answer was no. Those people could have been using a key escrow product. They would have been just as protected from their government. They would have been just as able to share information in confidence as they are with PGP, maybe better. The point is that a lot of companies, a lot of people in other countries have been asked whether they would buy a U.S. key escrow product. And their response is interesting. First of all, they just assume that somebody's going to have access to the key. Second, they're much more comfortable having the U.S. government able to listen to their communications than their own government. So that's an interesting thought. The other point about your about the question of who will we work with, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, we do not help countries repress their own people. And we do help American companies work and protect their own data around the world. Next question.
Okay, this is going to be the last question. Oh. I've been reminded twice now that
actually,
we have to stop on time.
How about make the last one the last question? Just kidding.
Thanks for being here, Mike, and throwing yourself to the lions. Look, you know, since you got up at the Mayflower Hotel last year and presented that new proposal, you have been pretty successful, either consciously or unconsciously, on keeping Louis free on a pretty short leash as far as him mouthing off about how he wants to outlaw encryption, although he never says he wants to outlaw private encryption. He talks about how encryption is a problem and that a solution has to be found somehow, some way. Now, I tend to believe you when you say that you wake up every morning, look in the mirror, and chant, you know, voluntary, voluntary, voluntary standards. And that's probably as good as long as Clinton's in the White House and maybe Gore.
Well, thanks for the endorsement.
But the fact is that there is, you know, that Louis Free has a Jones for this thing. If it was up to him right now, all private encryption would be outlawed. And only people in the United States would use, you know, government certified encryption or whatever. How long do we have to find this silver bullet before the FBI comes to you and says, look, you know, the body count's getting too high, or it's about to get too high. The problem, we've given you enough time, we've given you enough rope to try and find this silver bullet, like you said, but it's just not there. So here comes the doomsday edict. You know, all private encryption is outlawed, where it's handed down by mandate. How long of a time frame do we have before that happens?
I knew we should have taken the last question, the last question. But before I answer the question, I want to show you what they gave me when I came in here. All of you got the little packet with your name cards. I delivered the lunch tickets. And there was my name card. It said Dr. Clipper.
Someone must have broken security
and
on there.
And then, And then there was something else, and I wasn't sure where I was supposed to put this, but it said, kick me. But I now know I don't have to wear that, because you've already figured that out. I guess I should say, first of all, I would never pretend to speak for Louis Free, and then I won't today. And I frankly don't think it's Louis Free that you have to worry about. I think we have to worry about a very serious nightmare scenario, and that is that there'll be another heinous crime on the order of the World Trade Center, and we will have had the perpetrators under surveillance, or we will have had their data files, and we will have not been able to read them. And because of that, the crime will have been committed, we wouldn't have been able to prevent it. And it won't be Louis Free that will be raising holy hell. It'll be the American people, it'll be the local sheriffs, it'll be members of Congress. And that's my nightmare. And I think that's one we should really be worried about. And if we don't find a solution, if we don't find something that meets the needs of the different players, then we've got a very serious problem. And so I hope we can move forward on this. That's a government perspective. I think Nick had a perspective as well.
I have to say, from a global perspective, it's not a matter of strong encryption is going to be outlawed without some form of control, escrow, call it what you will. It's just merely a matter of when. And certainly, sitting in the Netherlands, we've had one brush with the authorities to say that they wanted to introduce a law similar to the French legislation. Fortunately, we were able to push it off with the economic reasons of why it wasn't a very good idea. That has not deterred them, and certainly they are coming back, and they do have legitimate concerns. If I could sort of put it to you in a way that was put to me a couple of days ago, I was told that there were two sorts of lawyers. There were sort of lawyers who told you what you could do and gave you advice, and they were horrendously expensive, but at least they gave you things to do. And then there was the other sort of lawyers who told you what you can't do, and they were very, very cheap.
No lawyers are very cheap.
And in this room, I hear lots of people telling me what we can't do. I, for one, who struggles with it in reality on a day-to-day basis, am paid to give advice of what we can do. I would like to hear more coming up to what we can do rather than what we can't do, because my belief is that encryption will be outlawed in some shape or form in the future around the world, if not in this country, somewhere else. And it will spread. And therefore, as a sort of speaker from commerce, I want to see that averted, and I want to see the standards. And so the debate shouldn't be a matter of it's out there, we can't do anything about it. They will. It isn't about will they outlaw encryption. They will. And then the response is, okay, if that's reality, how do we manage it?
Okay, we have to stop here and...